Election 2011 coverage on Manx Radio, brought to you by PDMS.
Hello, I'm Roger Watterson, and this is the third in our series of 15 constituency programmes in which we shall meet all of the candidates seeking a seat in the 2011 general election. Douglas has 8 MHKs in the House of Keys, and the town is divided into 4 constituencies of 2 members each. Today we'll focus on Douglas East and meet the 6 candidates contesting its 2 seats. Now, during the next hour, we shall explore their ideas and policies and listen to them discussing the most important issues of the day as they see them to be. All of this is to discover why the citizens of Douglas East should vote for them at the end of the month. But first, to tell us a little about the personality and history of the constituency, here's Dan Walker.
The constituency of Douglas East has the distinction in the Isle of Man of having the most recent experience of actually hosting an election in May 2010. The by-election was put in train by the elevation of one of the area's 2 sitting MHKs to the Legislative Council. Much has already been said of the 2010 by-election. Suffice it to say, it attracted 6 candidates and became one of the most bitterly fought contests in living memory. We must hope the upcoming general election doesn't give the legal eagles so much to chew over. A tour of the constituency starts with a pleasant stroll up the recently gentrified North Quay, past the sea terminal and along the promenade with its pretty Victorian frontage. Be careful not to get too distracted by the sights, keep one eye open for potholes and horse droppings. At the demolished Summerland you have a choice. On up Summerhill Road, where you can pause to admire plans for a vast new block of flats in the old quarry, or how about a climb up King Edward Road to Port Jack, where financial powerhouse Royal Scandia have their offices. Either way, you'll have to nip briefly into neighbouring Onchan, return along Victoria Road, which forms the border between Douglas East and Douglas North. On the way back to the start point, you may very well choose to pass by the Legislative Building, where the successful candidates will be taking up their seats in October. On the whistle-stop tour, a visitor couldn't help but notice the constituency encompasses most of the financial and business heartland of the island's capital, as well as the seat of executive power. It is also home to a somewhat diverse and transient group of people. At the last census, 3,035 voters made their home in Douglas East, but in 2010, only 37% chose to exercise their right to cast a ballot. On the minds of those who choose to vote, worries about the economy may well be front and centre. And no doubt they'd like to see successful conclusions to the Lord Street bus station and Summerland sagas. One thing is for certain though, whoever the 2 lucky candidates are come the general election, if they want to get anything done for their constituents, they'll need to have a close working relationship with their colleagues in Douglas Borough Council.
That was Dan Walker, and he was taking a brief look at Douglas East. Now to the candidates, in alphabetical order, as they will appear on the voting paper. Brenda Cannell was MHK for Douglas since 1996. John Caron is a chef. Richard Kizik is a businessman and a Douglas councillor. Paul Moulton, a radio and TV broadcaster. Geraldine O'Neill, a teacher with speciality in languages. And Chris Robertshaw, former MD of the Sefton Hotel and MHK for Douglas East since 2006. Now, at the beginning of each programme, and before any discussion, we invite the various candidates to speak to us. I beg your pardon, Chris is correcting me here. He was the candidate since 2010. Thank you, Chris. At the beginning of each programme, and before any discussion, we invite the various candidates to speak to us without interruption for 2 minutes on any subject of their choice. And we do this, too, in alphabetical order. So first, we go to Brenda Cannell.
Thank you, Roger. The first task for the newly elected members of the House of Keys will be to select a new Chief Minister, someone who shows skill and leadership in navigating a safe course for the island's future success and prosperity. The next Chief Minister must be brave and bold, and not only able to stand up to existing and further hostility from our neighbours in the United Kingdom and others abroad, but also equipped with the negotiation skills necessary to advance our status in the global economy. We have had weak political leadership over the last 5 years, illustrated by the last government's ready acceptance to the loss of the reciprocal health agreement. Instead of fighting to retain this, which is what the island's people expected, the government sought to impose private medical health insurance on the nation. It was through the people who united together, including a handful of members of the Keys, ably led by Speaker of the House of Keys, Steve Roden, who enlisted the support of Labour MP Andrew McKinley to lobby on our behalf, that we managed to save this vital agreement. The next 5 years are going to be very difficult, and the time has come for the next government to get tough and not allow itself to be bullied.
Brenda, thank you. Now, your 2 minutes, please. John Curran.
Hello. As a latecomer to this, I should introduce myself a little bit, blow my own trumpet, I think. I've long been interested in politics, but having a young son has prevented me, really. My life was devoted to him. He's now going to high school. He can look after himself a bit. So this is the time, I think, to get into politics. My main thrust will be honesty. We haven't had enough of it from previous governments. We haven't had enough information being provided, and it's led to governments that we cannot trust. We can't believe what they say because they've not always given us the full information that we require to decide whether they are sort of making the correct decisions on our behalf. What I would seek to do is to get every bit of information out of the government to enable MHKs to do their job, and they don't have that information there all of the time at the moment. Give them the time and the information on laws that are being brought forward, some scrutiny on these, which will inform MHKs of what they are voting on, rather than just blindly voting for whatever is put before them, and especially following the administration's line. That's got to stop, really. Reform of the government is necessary, but I think, in view of the sort of past performance of the last two governments, I could say, I would definitely call for an inquiry into that performance. And if heads have to roll because of that, or if there are comebacks for it, then I think that's something that's got to be done.
Right, John, thank you for that. Now on to Richard Kissing, please.
Hello, I'm a businessman and certified accountant with my wife running a recruitment agency in Douglas. I'm passionate about doing the right thing. I believe that this is a critical time for the island where we need real politicians with vision and strength of character. In April 2008, I stood for Douglas Council for Victoria Ward and was elected unopposed. I've served on various committees in the council, but most enjoy the Leisure Services Committee, which develops and maintains the parks and gardens, where I've also acted as vice chairman of the Pension Committee for the local authorities' pensions, which acts as trustees for the pension fund. Due to the global challenges of the credit crunch, which led to the renegotiating the VAT agreement between the Isle of Man and the UK, our government must face the challenges of a reduced income. We have many perceived problems, some genuine and some politically expedient. We shall have to make efforts to gather evidence and come to a sensible judgment. If we had seen the Millennium Bug coming, it may have saved us money. If we had seen Enron coming, then perhaps the MEA would be in less debt. There is a need for fully conscious people in government to navigate around these dangers. Douglas East is the most important part of the Isle of Man. It is the island's most important shopping centre. Most of the big hotels are based on Douglas Prom, namely the Sefton Palace and the Claremont. We've seen the Sea Terminal and Tynwald buildings, as well as the main parts of government. We have a very large portion of the finance sector based in East Douglas, as well as some of the best and worst housing. It's very important to me personally, as I live and work in East Douglas and have served on Douglas Corporation's Victoria Ward, which forms a large part of East Douglas. Unfortunately, we've been plagued by voter apathy in the past, but I beg people to vote on this occasion, because the thing Douglas East needs is for people to at least demonstrate that we care about our area. Even if you don't vote for me, then vote for someone you think cares and is capable of doing something positive. I think you should vote for me because I shall investigate issues, and I believe that which are important, and endeavour to have the courage to do something about them.
Right, thank you, Richard. Paul Moulton now, please.
Hello, I'm Paul Moulton. You might remember me from such classics as The Swap Shop here on Manx Radio some years ago. On a more serious note, I hope you do feel you know me already a little bit, as I've worked, of course, in the Manx media business all my working life. And now I feel it's time for me to step up to the plate and apply to you, the electorate, for the most important job of my life. To represent the constituency of Douglas East, the place I've lived all my adult life. This election sees the unusual position of almost all the candidates promising the same thing, to make those necessary cuts, be tough, and to balance the books. So this election is not so much down to policy, but who you can trust with your vote to keep us on track for the next 5 years. I didn't come to the decision to stand up for the House of Keys lightly, as I had to give up what many obviously describe as one of the better jobs around, being the ITV Granada correspondent for the island. But I knew, and I hope you don't think this sounds too big-headed, but I just knew this was a job I was meant to do. I finished at ITV at the end of August. I've only had a few weeks to get out onto the streets and to start canvassing, but I've managed to get round most of the patch, and in that time, I've met some fantastic people. There's no doubt in my mind, we live in one of the most amazing places in the world. Most of us, but not all of us, have a quality of life that puts us well above our near neighbours in the UK. What we need to protect is that lifestyle, but at the same time, doing it on nearly £500,000 less a day going to the government coffers. That will be a massive challenge. Three things have to be protected: health, pension and education. That's the core business of the government. Over the next hour, whilst you're having your tea or breakfast, if you're on the repeat, I hope I can convince you that I am the right man for the job. And I think by now, as I finish my 2 minutes, you'll have formed an opinion about me, and I hope it's one that someone you can feel you can trust and act for you, for the greater good of the island.
Thank you, Paul. Now we move on to Geraldine O'Neill.
Good evening. My name is Geraldine O'Neill. I'm standing for election in Douglas East. I've chosen to stand in Douglas East because I'm originally from here. I still have family connections here, and I live and work in Douglas. As a teacher, I have many past and present pupils and their families living in the constituency. Therefore, I'm aware of the needs, aspirations and concerns of the community in Douglas East. On a constituency level, if elected, I will give a commitment to holding regular constituency surgeries to advise, help and resolve issues of importance for constituents, such as vandalism, parking, speed limits, etc. I will liaise and network with local government bodies, the Douglas Borough Council, Neighbourhood Police, Age Concern, the Chamber of Commerce and the Youth Services. In my view, this is essential to provide an overview for all sections of the community living and working in Douglas East. I have also set the problem of derelict housing as one of my main priorities. To combat this growing problem, we need tougher penalties for owners and landlords, rent restrictions, less bureaucracy, and social legislation to back this up. On a national level, we need continued and sustained investment in education to provide all our young people with the necessary qualifications and skills to compete in the job market. Health provision for all sections of our society, both young and old. Standardised employees' contractual working agreements to ensure fair practice for all. In order to reduce our energy expenditure, we must research effectively the viability of wind, tidal and wave solutions for our future energy needs. Finally, to deliver these priorities for our nation, we must balance our budget, i.e. capital and revenue spending.
All right, thank you, Geraldine. And now, last but not least, Chris Robertshaw, please.
Thanks, Roger. To state the obvious, the biggest single task facing the next administration will be to balance the books whilst retaining our key services in good order. Everything, all our individual hopes and aspirations, whatever they might be, will depend on successfully achieving this single goal. There'll have to be significant cuts in government expenditure whilst at the same time doing everything possible to maintain growth in the economy at a very difficult time. There'll have to be a determination to retain our competitive tax environment whilst ensuring a fair taxation system. None of this will be easy in the present environment and will require a step change in how we think if we are to be successful. In achieving further cuts, government will have an enormous task ahead to recapture the leadership role it has squandered in recent years. To regain the confidence and trust of the electorate and those working in the civil and public services, the first steps must be to apologise for the failure of Tynwald to lead from the front over pensions, and to make it clear that the upper echelons of our civil service will not be immune from the cuts that have already been felt further down the service. To boost growth against the backdrop of increasing competition from emerging enterprise zones, we need to accept that the current model of interaction between government and the private sector is thoroughly outdated. The first signs in recognition of this are already emerging, but there is much to do. Barring further external shocks, I believe we can do all this, but no one should pretend it will be easy. I try to face up to these and many other issues, honestly, in my manifesto.
Right, that was Chris Robertshaw, and thank you all for your contribution. Well, now it's time for us to take a look at some of the issues of the day and some of the issues that all of you, in one way or another, have highlighted in your election literature. Now, Chris, you finished there by saying that you thought that Tynwald had squandered its leadership role. Its leadership in what and where?
Well, it's moral leadership. I mean, that's what it's there to do. it started at the beginning of 2006. All the signals were there before them to act in a particular way, and they threw it all away and just wasted the next 3.5 years. And then eventually, when they woke up, if that's the right phrase, they rushed the fences. Some of the structural changes made were inappropriate. They failed to deal with scope and the silo effect of government. And so, sadly, we arrive at the end of an incredibly important five-year period with little having been achieved. So, yes, they squandered the leadership.
But any incoming member, any incoming parliament now, of course, inherits a great deal of the arrangements and contracts and international deals that have been struck.
Yes, and particularly I think I'm talking about how we need to make government here more effective. In my manifesto, I outline in detail where I think we should make those changes.
Now, Brenda, in your documentation, you refer to the leadership issue as well, but you said that there is a need for strong leadership. There's an implication there, then perhaps we haven't had it.
We haven't had strong leadership. We've had a lack of direction. I mean, it's really essential that whoever leads the team the next time around will not only command the respect of members and the Isle of Man's people, but also has a degree of respect in the United Kingdom and abroad. This person's going to have to be a really, really good negotiator when they go off island to try and attract more business and investment here. That's going to be crucial in order to not only stabilise the economy, but also to source, you know, economic growth for the future. No, we've had very, very weak political leadership.
But as far as being able to do the things that you say and the things that Chris was talking about there, you need somebody of some talent, and not just talent, but experience. So we have two problems here, haven't we? New coming members to the House, not necessarily and very rarely would have the experience to do that, and a lot of the old ones are the people you're criticising.
I was criticising leadership being the one individual, the Chief Minister, who has led over the last 5 years. It's up to whoever is the Chief Minister to lead from the front, to lead by example. And that individual has got to select a very dynamic team of people that will support him or her in establishing that leadership, commanding that respect off island and giving support for good negotiation skills. I mean, that's the one thing we've always lacked, actually, in the Isle of Man. We have very, very hard-working civil servants, senior officers who are very good at what they do, but they are not negotiators. Negotiation skills are specialist skills, and that's where we lack when we have to negotiate ourselves either out of a corner or into a ring.
There's two styles of negotiating skill, isn't there, Paul? There's the business and commercial side and the general negotiations, and there's political negotiations, which are always led on a different level, administrative and political. But so what did you make of these two comments? Would you agree with these?
Well, there's a blame game going on here. I mean, let's face it, you've got only so many people, and you're right, Roger, who you can pick for the Chief Minister, and it's going to be someone that you already know, Brenda, isn't it? It's going to be someone that's already in there, because it's unlikely that someone's going to come straight in and take over that position. And I just wonder if you have confidence in any of them, that's all. I'd like to know, because, you know, is it personal or is it down to the business of the Isle of Man?
But it's essential for the Isle of Man that somebody who can eventually demonstrate those talents comes to the fore.
Well, and there's a few that come to mind immediately, and they've been selected by the various polls. I mean, Alan Bell must be up there. I mean, until you actually know who's in, then you obviously can't make that decision. But it was a beauty contest, possibly, the Chief Minister's job last time round. This time it's certainly not. It's going to be much more of who wants to take the flag.
If you're elected, Geraldine, what will you be looking for from your leader?
Well, I think we really need a team player this time. We need someone who will speak to the rest of the Council of Ministers, listen to advice, and I think all members of Tynwald really need to be part of the team that will be successful in government. I think we also need, rather than what's happened in the past, appointing people to various departments who might have perhaps skills, perhaps say in education, putting them in agriculture. I think the time for learning in departments is gone now. If we elect people with skills, and I hope we elect people with diverse skills in this Parliament, along with experienced people who are already there, that we will put people in positions where they can use their skills. If you were a football manager, you wouldn't put a defender playing in an attacking position. So for me, what I want to see really is people with skills being elected with a mixture of experience as well. And I think among the experienced people, there are people there who would be team players, who might not, because a leader doesn't have to have all of the skills themselves. In actual fact, leadership has to be someone who recognises the skills of the team.
Now, John Karen, if you're elected, what part do you think you would be able to play? What would you be looking to do in the team that Geraldine's talking about?
The team? Well, the team has to look after its chief minister. Going back to that question, you can't say we had a weak chief minister that's led to all our troubles, because there have been co-mins behind them. Now, if they were so weak that they couldn't control their chief minister and advise him correctly, then that means there were 10 of them there who were weak. So maybe they all need to go.
What would you replace them with?
There's bound to be, but you can't say that there were all 10 were weak. So you can't blame it all on a weak chief minister. He should have had direction from other people.
Except that, though, if there's not collective responsibility in the Council of Ministers, then they're not acting as individuals. If the chief minister decides the policy, then that's different.
Well, the chief minister doesn't decide all the policy. Some of it comes from the departments as well.
Yes, but I'm saying if he's not listening to the ministers, to the other ministers, then, and not taking into account their opinions, then, you know, he's not leading, or she's not leading, with a consensus government.
Well, Richard Kizik, what's your observations on this?
I think it's much more complicated than blaming one man. The chief minister is advised by his other political colleagues. He's advised by his civil servants. They're advised by consultants, external consultants, who come in and write their reports. And it's a brave politician who goes against that kind of written advice.
But it's also in a lot of places. If it was in a medical environment, you'd immediately, if you were uncomfortable, seek a second opinion.
Well, I think that's very wise, and certainly take his own view and perhaps investigate himself, which is one of my points, that I think that it's very, very, very important in the Isle of Man that we have a strong and virile media.
Is there a danger, Paul, that we might end up in the old Shakespearean situation where Caesar surrounds himself by weak men?
Let's be clear about what's gone on over the last 5 years. People around here are seriously saying that every decision by government was wrong. It was a bad government because I can't believe that people don't go into it thinking they're doing the right thing. And hindsight is just fantastic for all of us to remember. There has been some highs, there's been some lows. We didn't know we were having it so good, which is clear that now, looking back, how much money that was going and sloshing around. But you know, you can't blame it on Tony Brown. I'm sorry, not alone.
Well, Paul, great. Well done for being an apologist for the last Council of Ministers. I mean, it was blatantly obvious to me in 2006 that if Tony Brown became the chief minister, we were heading for trouble. I mean, that's not hindsight. That was obvious. And the fact of the matter is, and we have to face this too, that the last house failed to choose its chief minister. It couldn't even decide that.
Well, it was a beauty contest, wasn't it? It purely who would do the least damage, as far as they're concerned.
It didn't have a set of policies, and it couldn't even decide who the chief minister was. Now, 5 years later, we've really got to face the music and get on with the job.
Do you want it?
You see, one of the main problems is that the Tynwald, they elect if you like, or select a chief minister, and then it goes to a secret ballot, and then there's a public vote afterwards, and that person is then elected by Tynwald. The problem flows after that, because the chief minister then goes away and draws up a list of who he wants to invite to be ministers, and Tynwald has no say in that. Those ministers are not appointed by Tynwald. They don't. It's all about patronage, Paul. It's about the chief minister picking people either that he knows he can work with, or perhaps easily manipulate, so that he does in fact push his own policies forward.
You don't think it'll be the same next time round? That's what I'm saying. I mean, I think it will be a strong lead. I think everyone's agreed here. Mm. It won't be the beauty contest of who will do the least damage, or who will give me a nice job.
Roger asked about weak political leadership. Mm. And he came to me and he asked me the question based on that. And that's what we're talking about. You see, that is wrong. That is not democratic. If you're going to put a cabinet, let me finish, please.
You have to name some names that you're going to back finish. Who have demonstrated this leadership.
I don't have to name names at all.
Let's not dwell too much in the past, to be honest. This is looking forward.
Who are highly experienced, have a high integrity, both on the Isle of Man and abroad. And I sincerely hope that they are returned. I'll name them. One is Steve Roden and the other one is Alan Bell. Both are very capable of leading the nation.
Right, now let's just then go a stage further. Geraldine, you were saying that whenever the new administration gets in place, yes, then the whole aspect of the whole working of government, the government that you then might belong to, will have to be carried out. And you said in your documentation that you thought it should be carried out by the civil service.
Well, what I meant by that is we need a review in every department of expenditure to see what we really need to spend money on. Do we need to have the top layers of management, etc., and where we can actually save money constructively and effectively? Because I do believe that
And isn't the civil service the right vehicle to do this with? I mean, this is the turkeys voting for Christmas.
Again, they have to be the people who analyse figures, as they're the people who produce the figures. Presumably, the minister in charge of each department will then have the wherewithal to look at that and see what is effective. I mean, my belief on sort of senior management in departments is we have an education, and in health and in the other services of government, value added. I can say what my value added is, a nurse can say what her value added is, but I would like to see the people in these high positions showing what their value added is. For example, if you've marketing manager in the Department of Economic Development, what do they actually produce? What have they found are the markets for the Isle of Man? What's their knowledge of the Isle of Man? Unfortunately, I think we've had in the past some people appointed to positions who've had little or no knowledge of the Isle of Man and have not been able to pursue those jobs as they should.
Now, you, Chris, to a certain degree in your documentation, went at that from another angle, because you said that the restructuring that went on just at the latter end of the last house was clumsy and the scope was ignored completely. We were saying that lost opportunities there as well. I mean, do you agree with Geraldine that the departments themselves should be asked to adjust themselves?
No, I think the evidence is all there that there's been a failure so far. In the year that I was in, I spent a significant amount of the time looking at the various departments, just quietly going around. And frankly, I concluded that there are actually two departments more than there should be. So there's two departmental structures at the top end that are completely unnecessary and a complete waste of money.
Which are those, Chris? Which ones?
Department of Community, Culture and Leisure and the Department of Social Care. I'm not suggesting that the functions within those departments should actually disappear. I'm saying that the senior management, the ministers, the chief executives, those roles should disappear, because in my analysis, all the functions that those two departments carry would be better placed elsewhere. And that's why I say that the restructuring of government was badly rushed headlong all of a sudden. And I'm content that we could save a significant number of millions of pounds by doing that. But we do something else as well. It would send a signal to the lower ranks in the civil service and the public service that it wasn't all going to come down to them from the top, because that's what's been happening. And that's why, to answer your question, I can't agree with Geraldine, because as you said, it is Turkey's voting for Christmas, and there's got to be a much stronger central dynamic to deal with this.
Well, To come to that conclusion that you've made there, I have been and spoken to the Chamber of Commerce and talked to them, and they mentioned the new executive or the executive of the Chamber of Commerce that 10 years ago private business went through the same kind of analysis of putting their house in order and shedding excess in departments. And I think, with all due respect to my colleagues here, that this new government will have to look at all of these things. There will be no question of this, and there will have to be self-analysis, because if there isn't, then we're not going to be able to balance our budget, and we're not going to be able to serve the daily expenditure revenue of our island.
The point I was trying to make, Roger, was that if you are honest enough and open enough to say that cuts can be made at any level, and that the staff in the government departments recognise this, they're much more likely to engage in bottom-up
cost-cutting as well. Yes, but that's why I'm saying we have to look from the top.
Because I think they've missed a real opportunity going around the constituency, and I'm sure my fellow candidates have heard the same thing. There's a disappointment with the way the restructuring occurred. There was they've missed opportunities, and they've lost a certain amount of enthusiasm.
Well, part of the reason for that restructuring, of course, was to rebuild the government structure and help to rebuild aspects of the economy as well, and the way that they operated. Now,
yes, but the DED, Roger, is actually currently structured. In an old-fashioned manner, and I said in my opening remarks that DED, the government and the private sector have to find new ways of working together if it's going to be successful.
Well, John Cannon, now, but the burden in your documentation, you say the burden of rebuilding the economy is spread fairly, must be spread fairly to all sectors of our society to protect the weak and vulnerable from bearing more than their share. Well, what are you looking for there?
Well, that's right. There's a large sector of our common, the working population, really, who are sort of the bottom 25% are really not very well off. They've been left behind by the boom in the finance sector. And these people need jobs creating, and that should be the first priority of the new government, is to sort of do everything possible to create jobs, which would be the economic development's position to sort of work on that.
Isn't that what it's doing now?
It is, but it must be made to do more, and it's the sector that they're trying to create jobs for. It's okay creating 20 jobs in the space industry. That's not helping the sort of 10,000 people who are earning less than 15,000 a year.
You get an inkling of what DED will have to do ultimately in the very recent initiative between the Chamber of Commerce and the DED.
Which is a very positive one.
One, and it's a different balance, it's a different approach altogether.
It's a partnership.
Yeah. Well, you see, the government itself, in the way that it costs and the way that it delivers, of course, I mean, a lot of the costs of government is tied up in this, perhaps sometimes, as you just said, rather old-fashioned way of delivery. Yet, Richard, in your documentation, you refer to lack of customer service throughout government. What did you mean by that?
There appear to be training courses which people have gone on how to treat people, and it just results in appalling behaviour from some people. I mean, my own family have ended up boycotting the NSC because of the staff there being rude to our kids, and. You know, their defence will be that they were enforcing health and safety and looking after the children's. How many times can you tell small children not to run around? I mean, it's a swimming pool. You enjoy yourself, and that's what the kids are meant to do.
Can I just say, Roger, before you carry on with that? Can I just say, going back to the scope and structure of government, I think we have to be mindful that there was a scrutiny committee that actually considered that and studied that and took evidence over that and produced a report to Tim Wald in July, the last sitting of Tim Wald, which confirms that in fact it was the Chief Minister himself who went away and put that structure together. Now, people are surprised that there was no change, that you still had 9 departments. I'm not surprised, because it's all a numbers game in the House of Keys.
You've got
24 elected members, and the key figure is 13 to either pass or block something.
Yes, but the question is not so much the past now, because people today are voting for the future.
Yes, they are.
So
but Chris would like to review it all again.
Oh, would you?
Well, there are. He's right in terms of the two departments he has identified. There are two departments that are that really should be incorporated with other things. But I think what we need to do is to be focusing on those services that are underutilised by the public, that are causing huge losses to the taxpayer, huge deficits, to consider whether or not we can go for corporatisation of those services if they are really needed, or get rid of them altogether.
Which ones are you talking
and
about?
I don't think it's just a case of looking at job
numbers.
Why
haven't you brought this up before, Brenda?
Job numbers is a knee-jerk reaction to the actual problem. It's easy to look at jobs and say, well, we'll cut your job.
Have you been waiting for Chris to bring up these two departments that we need to
highlight? What you need to identify is I can actually testify that, having served on 8 government departments, held 3 chairmanships on statutory boards, that there are certain services that are underutilised by the public.
Which ones are you talking about?
Well, I will be covering those in my manifesto.
So you're not going to tell us now?
No, I'm not going to tell you now.
Well, don't you know?
If you do your research and do your study into this...
No, if you come up with something, you should back it up, that's all. If you say
it. You will see yourself. There are services... You mentioned the likes of the NSC. The NSC, huge losses to the public taxpayer. The NSC CAFE, huge losses to the taxpayer. That might be better being franchised, possibly. You look at the wildlife park, huge losses to the taxpayer, but very romantic about keeping it. Well, why not gift it to the wildlife park charity to actually oversee? You look at the Villa Marina, the Villa Marina and the Gaiety Theatre. Again, fabulous events. We should hold on to the buildings and the structures, but could they be better managed?
Why haven't you been highlighting these over the last few years?
How do you know I haven't been highlighting them, Richard?
I haven't heard you.
I've hardly seen you in the public gallery.
We will come back in a minute, Geraldine, because at that point, I'm obliged to go for a very short commercial break.
Election 2011 coverage on Manx Radio, brought to you by PDMS.
And welcome back to the election special. Our studio guests are all candidates for the Douglas East by-election, and we have Chris Robertshaw, Geraldine O'Neill, Paul Moulton, Richard Kizik, John Carron and Brenda Cannell. And we've been talking about a range of subjects, and so often happens in discussions, we sort of wander off onto various places. But we were talking about, before we went to the break, John Carron started to talk about the burdening of rebuilding the economy and the benefit that it goes to people further down the line. But there have been some warnings sounded just lately. Brenda, I'll go to you first, because I know that you're featuring this, and that is that with the change in the ARI certificates, that's the method of taxing companies that are resident Manx companies, warnings have been sounded, not warnings I understand that have been particularly accepted by the Treasury, but warnings outside the Treasury have been sounded that this could cause a further blow to the government revenue.
Absolutely. I mean,
do you have any views on that?
Oh yes, I do, and I'm very grateful to a former assessor of income tax for actually producing the documentation in respect of this, which has now more or less become public, as I understand it. The European Code Group have been putting pressure on the Isle of Man since 1999, when they found that 6 of the local taxation measures were not regarded as good as the Isle of Man, and indeed they said, well, they're harmful, so they've got to go. And so in 2006, the government introduced a new tax initiative, which was called the Zero 10. Now, the Zero 10 was to attract more business to the Isle of Man, high net worth individuals to the Isle of Man. But if they were wealthy enough, when they opened a Manx registered company and put all of their assets in, their land, their stocks, their shares, their property, and a trading company, and they were wealthy enough not to require to draw off the profits from the trading company, then under the Zero 10, they're actually exempt from any income tax. In order to compensate that, the ARI came in. Now, of course, Europe is saying the ARI is not compliant, it's harmful, it's got to go by April next year. Now, what will that mean is that Treasury will lose their capacity to be able to charge at least 10% to these individual shareholders. That will go altogether. We don't know what that quantifiable loss is likely to be, because Treasury have kept this very close to their chest. The other thing that greatly disturbs me is that it will create a two-tier system. in that the very wealthy people will be exempt from income tax completely, whereas the ordinary person or the smaller business person who has to draw off the profits from the trading company for living expenses, to pay staff wages, etc., will be hit by a 20% tax by touching those profits.
So we're talking about an iniquitous arrangement again,
yes,
now, where the least able to afford will be paying. That's what we're saying. Right, so this is a danger in the background. Now, I don't know if all of your other people here have read, we're talking about Mark Solly's papers, but, I mean, Richard, have you had any views on this?
I haven't had a chance to read them, but I would imagine that there's a way around that.
Well,
a more equitable tax.
Why haven't our MHKs been pressing the Treasury to release this information? That's the whole tenet of my standing. They need to get the information from the Treasury as to what they believe the effect will be, and what comebacks they've had, what meetings they've had within the pressure groups from within industry.
Have you considered this, Paul?
It's a sad fact of life, isn't it, that rich people won't pay tax, and there's not much you can do about that. You can't touch a zero, because if you charge any companies even 1%, they'll be off to one of 30 other jurisdictions that will accommodate
them. But you can't just take their threat as stated. Our friend Richard Murphy was on Radio 4 tonight saying these 50% people will all leave England if they don't reduce this tax. And Richard Murphy, dear old Richard, said, they always say this and they never go. We can't just take a threat from any part of industry.
High net worth people are important to the Isle of Man, because in the e-gaming business, for instance, the average salary is £50,000. That's fantastic.
But we had 50 here
Those are bringing people who then into the Isle of Man, who then go and shop, they buy things, and they add to the economy.
So
that's got to be good
everyone
news.
Everyone adds to the economy. That's why.
If you've got more money to spend, you've got more to get rid of.
If you can bring the bottom end up, they'll
spend into the
economy.
It's interesting, just to counteract what Paul's saying here, it's interesting because there is a debate currently in other countries abroad, in Europe in particular, where the actual rich people living in these communities are asking their governments to charge them more tax so that they can help the financial burden that each country has. Now, that is currently going on. I mean, I listened to some of that.
Have you detected any such mood in the Isle of Man?
No, but then, you know, things
you're,
always...
You're telling me that somebody's asking to pay more tax? They can donate money in any way they want. I mean, they can buy the wildlife park if they want to do it that way.
Part of our problem,
MHKs are going to pay for their pension, I believe.
Part of our problem at the moment is that the Isle of Man's USP is low taxation, and we absolutely have to recognise that and hold to it firm and hard. At the same time, quietly step back and try to make sure that we're doing everything we possibly can to make our tax system equitable for the lower paid. And it's a tremendous challenge, and we shouldn't go rushing around doing anything dramatic. We've got to be stable.
I wasn't saying we should do it.
Incidentally, there's no secret about the amount of money that will be lost currently through our it's about, give or take, it's about 2.7 million.
So far?
Up to now, yes. I mean, I grant you the fact that later on revenues would be posted into companies in a way to avoid tax, so that figure could go up. But we should not turn around and say we're not going to stop ARI. We should do what we said we're going to do, and then quietly consider the future over time to make sure that we...
Well, I don't think we have got the time to do that, because we can't... If that's going to go in April next year and there's no contingency, government has no contingency...
Let me finish.
I think what we really do need is a new, coherent national tax strategy developed straight away.
Treasury are one of the most competent departments in the government, and I have an awful lot of faith in people like Malcolm Couch and his team, and the previous ministers, both Alan Bell and Annie Crane. So they have the control of it.
Richard, what I have to say to you is there was a tax commission. We've had tax commissions in the past that actually reported to the government of the day. It was a public report, and they laid the foundations for the fact that we've risen to all beyond all expectations in monetary wise over the last 20-25 years. There is nothing wrong with putting together a tax commission to look at, and we need to have somebody on that commission that has got either previous experience by working with the European Code Group, or knows their thinking and culture. It's no good just coming up with these good initiatives.
Are you saying that Malcolm Couch doesn't?
No, I'm not. Absolutely not.
He's a fully competent, very intelligent man.
Our chief officers are very good at what they do.
Hasn't Malcolm Couch actually said, Geraldine?
Let's give her because she's been quiet throughout all this so far. Geraldine, what do you
well,
think?
Well, I just wanted to say that hasn't Malcolm Couch actually said that he's confident that he will be able to devise strategies to recoup some of this loss?
Yeah.
And again, I have to say, I would agree with Richard here. I would have confidence that he knows what he's talking about, as he's an expert in that field. And also, I think the ARI too, we have to remember that to continue with the EU Protocol 3, that actually, if we don't comply with the EU and we continued with the ARI, then they could go for the zero taxation, and that would be much worse for our economy.
We do have a little bit of time, though, to answer Brenda's point, because if it finishes in 2012, the actual revenue recovery doesn't stop till 2013-14, so yeah. We've got a little bit of time.
Yes, Roger, can we talk about the media?
Well, funny you should just say that, because that's the next one I've got, because all of you have talked about, in some way or other, their media, and the first thing, I'll come back to you in a minute, Richard, because the first thing I was going to ask was Paul,
who's
a media
why.
Man. And you actually have said in your documentation that you thought you would try to improve the way the government gets its message over to the public. You said that in
totally,
your manifesto.
Yeah.
Now, that implies, of course, that it's not doing it.
Well, I've been there, I've seen it, and I've got the video, haven't I, of the whole thing, because it doesn't explain itself necessarily that well. And it is amazing that when I've been the journalist, I've been the one trying to get the information out. And it isn't difficult. I mean, even over the VAT thing, I recorded the whole press conference and put that online at Manxtube and got thousands of hits where people themselves could actually sit there and listen to that information. That information is what's imparted to the journalists, who then passes it on to their various outlets. There's been obviously classic disasters, probably maybe a bit strong, but you know, over the VAT and the health agreements and the way that message has got out to the public.
No message at all for a while.
Well, the way it's all done now these days is to shove out a message, see if it works, and then you can work on it. And that's a typical standard way of dealing with these things. And the last time that the VAT was being hit, it did come out, didn't it? You notice that? We kept being told it's going to be hit again. By the time it actually arrived, it almost...
So how would you improve it all?
How do you improve it? You be as more transparent if you can be. You explain things more. And it is a question of using the media to your advantage.
Roger, we've got too many press officers in government. What we need are ministers who will stand up and speak to the people directly. There's 83,000 of us. Yeah. For goodness sake, if the ministers can't speak to the people without going through media, then it's a bit of a poor show. And it's an opportunity, again, for the ministers to hide behind their media representatives and to listen too much to the chief officers. It's about time we had ministers who the people could have trust in, understand, and speak to directly.
At what point were you going to make then, Richard?
Well, I was just thinking that there needs to be more virile and investigative media. I think that an awful lot of our media is dependent upon government money, and therefore...
Give me an illustration of that. If you say it, of course, you must have thought through that there must be some dependency on government. Are you talking about financial, or are you talking about the availability of communications and
news? Well, the media hasn't put pressure on the Department of Social Care to publish an external inquiry into social care of kids in care. That needs to become, and it needs to be put a much higher priority.
Now, how would you do that? Because the cost, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but the cost of investigation and the cost of this sort of pressure is a very expensive process. Do you think, especially with an advertising downturn, that sort of body is available to do this within the media?
Well, I don't think it is, no. But the media take the easy option and become more of a repeating service.
Can I do something very wrong?
Sorry, Chris, if you have freedom of access access to information legislation, you wouldn't have this problem.
Yeah, and there's another thing, and God help me for actually defending the media here. You know, I mean, this comes very difficult for me. But remember, if you go back and look at the how things have been structured since the ministerial system came in, you've had everybody in government and very few, as it were, external voices. But with effect from October onwards, there's going to be four select committees with the chairman outside of government, and they will give, if you like, an opportunity for an alternative view to come forward at each stage, and that will mean that the media will have the opportunity for perhaps a more balanced opinion or a balanced set of views.
I would prefer it if those established scrutiny committees were totally outside of government. Members of Parliament, but totally all of them, not just the chair, but the membership as well.
I think it's important to explain how it works at the moment with the Chief Minister. On a Friday morning, the three radio stations are brought in, one at a time, and the newspapers. Funny enough, Granada and BBC aren't invited to that party because they haven't got time for it, which I find strange. Anyway, and four or five messages will be presented to the media, and they'll be dripped out over the weekend. It's copy and paste, a lot of it. It's just, there's the message, please deliver it. Not much challenging goes on
there.
That's
boring media,
and
that is
a problem. A worry.
So how do we get a media like the Black Dog? Do you remember the Black Dog newspaper that used to come out?
No.
That was very, very risky.
Thanks forums.
Yes, thanks
forums.
But
it's a difference, isn't it?
Roger, you remember the police on the burglaries in the night shift. How did that break in the media?
Yeah, but I don't know. But the problem...
Yes, you do.
The problem that you've got with that sort of publication, of course, it's not credible, is it? It's sort of pub talk, it's word of mouth. If you want the investigative journalism you're talking about, you have to really have people who...
There has to be that as well. There has to be all sorts of...
Now, look, I'm going to have to stop you all here now, because I literally want... this is going to tax you. This is going to teach you politics at its tightest. Can I go round the table and ask you for one vast sentence? And I mean, like, four words, five words. Why should they vote for you, Brenda?
I've always been outspoken in the interest of my constituents, and I wish to continue the very good working relationship.
Sean Carroll?
I'll be honest, and I shall get every bit of information out of the government and make it work for the people.
Richard Keswick?
Because I have the courage to do what's right.
Paul Bilton?
I think I'm a new man coming from a new way of doing it, and check it out at manx1.com for more information.
Geraldine O'Neill?
I think we need candidates with varied skills and abilities in order to tackle the demanding issues we're going to have in the next 5 years. And as a Manx person, I would like to safeguard and promote our unique language, culture and identity for future generations.
And the last to Chris Robertshaw.
35 years experience in business. I'm now, I hope, up to speed in politics. I'd like in the next administration to bring those two together and make them work for the benefit of everyone.
Thank you all. Well, there we must end this election programme, which featured the candidates for Douglas East in the 2011 general election. They were Chris Robertshaw, Geraldine O'Neill, Paul Moulton, Richard Keswick, John Carron and Brenda Cannell. And tomorrow at the same time, Beth Espy will beat the four candidates for Douglas North. The constituency profile was by Dan Walker. The programme was produced by Catherine Nicol and Mark Tarley. I'm Roger Watterson. Goodbye.